Jeanette.
Hi, I'm Jeanette Wheeler, the pre-med advisor here, and I have had the great luck to have found this place because I've just met so many of you wonderful people here, and I'm pleased to say that we are still producing some superb people in medicine who are both ethicists and humanitarians and very bright individuals, and we're really doing it. And it's a pleasure to have you all here today, seeing you together. In answer to this, there's one exciting thing that's just happened recently. There used to be a National Health Service Corps in which you could get your money, get your tuition paid for medical school if you decided to go and practice in these rural areas.
For a short time.
Right. What there is just opening up now is the opportunity to find out if you would like to do this and also get your tuition paid back. So that some of these humanitarian type of physicians, which we have here, who really would be marvelous in practicing in these areas, will have the opportunity to do this and also get their debts paid if they can get into this. So I think that's one very exciting thing.
In trying to think of what Haverford should do, why shouldn't Haverford spearhead the restoration of the National Health Service Corps?
That's what I've been doing.
I wanted to add one comment real quick.
That would be addressing a problem.
It's shrunken, but it still exists. It still exists. It's just shrunken badly.
Yes, but
it's shrunken way down.
Yeah. We've just finally gotten through Nancy Cassidone has helped push that through.
To the person that was asking a question earlier about the career, I didn't at all mean to diminish the importance of the basic bedside physician. That is clearly a premier role. And that's the role that that's the only role that I imagine as I decided many years ago that I wanted to pursue medicine. But I would have to emphasize that the wonderful, beautiful thing about the American medical educational system is that there are all these infinite possibilities to pursue. I think it's very hard in advance to tell you where you're going to be unemployed. I personally don't think any of us are going to be unemployed because I think there are always new questions to answer. I don't think that biomedical technology or my clot lysing drugs are going to alleviate problems. You'll be employed no matter what you do. You should do what you like.
In the Philadelphia Inquirer as suggesting that one of the answers to the current problems between physicians and their patients is what they studied in undergraduate college. And at least the impression I got from the Inquirer article was the idea that most current physicians in practice felt they should not have studied science in undergraduate school. Is this the reflection of what your study said?
This is a study that Jeanette Wheeler helped us on. It's a study of graduates of Haverford, Swarthmore, and Franklin's Marshall College from the mid-50s to the early 80s. It was striking how pleased they were at having become physicians, but even more pleased at having had a liberal arts education. They did on reflection, though, on average, wish they had studied more art, music, history, and English literature than they had indeed studied. More of them wished they majored in the humanities than had majored in the humanities. And they wished they'd studied less chemistry, biology, physics, and mathematics than they did. They studied all that science. And again, these are average numbers. I'm sure there were many who wished they'd studied more science. But they, on average, said they'd studied so much science because that's what they were told they had to do to get into medical school. They wished they'd studied more humanities, both for their own personal development and because, on reflection, having had a career in medicine, they thought it would have helped them in their practice.
Could I comment on that for just a minute, Tom?
Sure.
I think the ideal medical school applicant in many schools, and I'm speaking from the perspective of one, is a student at a good liberal arts college or university who has been a humanities major and got A in biology and chemistry. No, I'm serious now. That's the ideal candidate. So that if you are trying to decide between chemistry and biology versus religion or Spanish or something, if you've got it, do religion or Spanish or something. But don't get C's in organic chemistry.
Anne Somers, formerly professor at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School and wife of a former professor at Haverford College. I'd make a couple of points. First, on the ethics issue, and I speak as a resident of a CCRC, also Bill, and a long-time Medicare patient. There are two very practical things that physicians and others in the healthcare establishment can do, I think. One is to encourage all of your patients, whether in your all private offices or on admission to a hospital or to a nursing home, to sign a living will, or even better still, the durable power of attorney, which enables somebody else to speak for you when you can no longer speak for yourself. There are always going to be squabbles in families. There are squabbles over ordinary wills, and you're never going to outlaw that completely. But if the individual has signed, sealed, and delivered with witnesses, and laws and state laws differ and are more or less effective on that, but if that is in writing and in the hands of your physician, in the hands of the admission office of the hospital, and it should be just as important as the questions they ask you about whether you have Blue Cross or Medicare coverage, that will help very much to make the decision easier. Secondly, the institution, whether it's a hospital that you are affiliated with or a nursing home or whatever, should have what has already been referred to as an institutional ethics committee, which can certainly help, call it God's form or whatever, it can certainly help not only the physician to make the difficult decision, but the family, and to help reconcile the families. The second point is, I should also say that for those of you who are really interested in this subject, there is a functioning Delaware Valley Ethics Committee network functioning right here in this area, and this is a slight commercial, I guess. On December 15th, at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, there will be a general session on ethical and legal issues of withholding life-sustaining therapy with three physicians, and Paul Armstrong, who is the lawyer who defended the Karen Quinlan case and has been a leader in New Jersey all along in discussing this, will be there to talk on the subject.
Thank you very much. Chris?
I have a question that I'd like to address to Dr. Miller, but also to other panelists as well. For us who here, who are in the audience that hopefully will be doctors in the future, I guess doctors or now present doctors, what do you foresee as the future in malpractice management, especially when the malpractice costs and lawsuits are increasing to such a level that it might be infeasible for insurance companies to even carry malpractice in the foreseeable future?
Well, you've asked a very important question about which I'm only partly informed, so I'll try to be brief, and maybe others here can add to it.
The only lawyer that I know left the room about a half an hour ago.
We got enough of them anyway. I think, is there another lawyer out here?
Joe, a lawyer physician.
That's right.
I think that the only honest thing to say is that whatever is going to happen is evolving, so there's no way to look ahead in my mind with certainty by me or by others. I think that there is dissatisfaction both with among patients, among institutions, among doctors, and among lawyers themselves with the current tort system. It's recognized to have strengths and to have many disadvantages, and surely justice in our society can still be partially achieved with money and with legal action. So I don't think there's going to be a throwing of the baby out with the bathwater. My sense is that we, as doctors, must acknowledge that failure to communicate between doctor and patient is one of the primary contributors to malpractice, so that the medical profession by no means comes into this discussion with clean hands. And secondly, it's been well studied that the most common cause of malpractice suits is malpractice. So stated another way, poor medical practice exists and is not going to go away. I would think that there would need to be some way to speed the system, presumably by review panels that were not as legalistic, reserving the tort system for the occasional case instead of the routine case. There are some steps in that regard already. And I think perhaps, to my mind, justice would come about most quickly if there was some way in which the contingency basis legal fees could be looked at carefully. As you probably know now, if you are aggrieved, you can bring suit, and a lawyer will be reasonable, will be available to help you in your suit, will advocate your suit, and will receive a certain percentage of the money if you make any money. If you don't get any money, he doesn't get anything. So the idea of the lawyers becoming millionaires by doing this, again, is an overstatement. On the other hand, at the present time, my opinion is, there may be difference of opinion here, is that often the outcome of the malpractice action is dependent more upon the skill of the lawyer than it is upon the merits of the case and or the outcome to the patient. And I think we need to address that, particularly in such a way that extraordinary sums of money do not bring extraordinarily high rewards to the lawyer. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you and I have two instances and I get $20,000 and you get $25 million, I think there should be an adjustment of the amount of money accruing to the people who were your counselors so that they shouldn't get one-third of $25 million and my guy get $25,000 of
$2,000. Steve?
It seems to me that the most useful way of looking at the malpractice liability crisis, and I think that that's been as good a summary of where it's going as I've ever heard anybody say, Jim. I think the most useful way to look at it is in the context of a larger problem in American society, of which the malpractice liability thing is a part, a significant part, but maybe not even the biggest part. And that is our excessive resort to litigation and the tort system for product liability. It's gotten to the point where no hotel swimming pool has got a diving board. And as a matter of fact, hotels being built today, the swimming pool is never more than 3.5 feet deep. I read in the paper a year or two ago that the outstanding legal actions against the manufacturers of football helmets exceeds threefold the total sales of football helmets in the United States every year. Clearly, the people who are injured by inferior products have a right to be compensated for their injuries, and we need to have a system of justice that assures that. That's true whether we're talking about an unsafe car or a bad doctor or an unsafe football helmet or whatever it is that we're talking about. We clearly also in this country, with our American genius for innovation, have managed to put together the most inefficient, unjust, and expensive way of dealing with that social problem that any nation has ever put together. And I would hope that someday our lawmakers will see to it that we get some sense into that. But to think of the malpractice thing as a standalone issue is a mistake.
Yes, one down here, please.
One second.
Yeah.
I'd like to just add a few things to that discussion as well. I agree completely that the problem has to be viewed as a societal problem, not just a medical problem, and the litigious society that we're in is a major player. I have to disagree a little bit with what Jim said, that the major cause of malpractice suits is malpractice. I think the statistics are that if you look at the number of suits activated, only a small percentage of them are really malpractice. And I think there's one important thing. It's important to separate, and this separation, unfortunately, is being blurred, between a bad result and malpractice. Those are two entirely different concepts, and that's being blurred so that anyone who gets a bad result has the concept that was malpractice, and therefore there should be suit. We cannot function with 100% results. We do not function with 100% results. Nobody functions with 100% results. We get bad results. We get bad results when we've done everything as well as we possibly can. That's a bad result. That's not malpractice. That distinction needs to be reestablished, and it's being blurred currently. Another thing is that the malpractice issue is used two ways. It's used as a remedial system for bad doctors and as a reward system for people who've been aggrieved by true malpractice. Now, those two things should be separated. The remedial process, the judgment that a physician has not done a good job, should be a separate process from the reward. The reward should stand on its own if he has done a bad job, but there are bad jobs that are done that are malpractice, that are not appropriate medical care, that don't lead to a suit. So that the other side of the coin is that we have to weed out the physicians who are not doing a good job, whether a suit was established or not, and we have to separate from the court system the idea of punishing the doctor and rewarding the patient. And in that regard, I think either a no-fault system, as now exists in many states in automobile injuries, will play an important role, or secondly, setting up courts like the land court, which are simply medical malpractice courts, where the jury does not play a role, but it goes before a tribunal of judges who are experienced in the complexities of the problem and have a better understanding of the inherent limitations of what we do and who are less emotionally moved by some of the bad things that happen in medicine.